This is the Human Action Podcast, where we debunk the economic, political, and even cultural myths of the days. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Murphy.
George, welcome to the Human Action Podcast.
Thanks, Bob. Glad to be here.
So I had come across your article on Mises.org recently talking about Thomas Paine, who's been one of my heroes for a while and probably going back to undergrad days at the very least. And I thought, hey, let's bring this guy on to talk about it. So before we dive into the particulars of Paine, can you just give a little background? Like, how did you become such a fan of the man and a scholar of his output?
Well, I think like most people, I had heard of Thomas Paine in high school in history classes when they said, well, the American Revolution was really got a shot in the arm when Paine wrote Common Sense. And as I recall, nothing in particular was said about Common Sense as such, or about Thomas Paine. And I just assumed he was some guy in the backwoods of the colonies that came up with this wonderful essay, and people read it and said, wow, you know, and we went on from there. But he was a powerful writer. If you've read his stuff, you know what I mean. You just can't ignore it. And the colonies at the time, the literacy rate was rather high, and people had little else to do but read things if they wanted to know what's going on in the world. So a pamphlet written about the advantages of independence would be well received. And Paine wasn't just saying, well, it's a good idea to be independent from England. He did say that, but it was actually a call to action. I said, we can do this. You know, this is we don't have to just, you know, England's the great powerful force in the world, but we are too. And if we stand up to these guys, we can win our independence. So the more I learned about that, and then the fact that he didn't just write that essay, he went and joined the Continental Army. Some of the other soldiers remarked that he was not a very good soldier, but you know, he was a better writer than a soldier. But he nevertheless was there. He was the aide-de-camp for General Nathaniel Greene, whatever that means, whatever position that means. And he was there when Washington was hovered on the other side of the Delaware River in late December, waiting to attack the Hessians in Trenton. And the troops were just completely demoralized, cold and so on and so forth. And Washington taps Paine on the shoulder and says, can you write us an essay? Something. We need to, these guys just want to go home. They don't want to fight anymore. So he, according to legend, borrowed the guy, a drummer's drum, scratched out this first of what became known as the American Crisis Essays, had it published, or printed at least, and took it back to camp where all the soldiers were. And Washington liked it, had his officers read it to the troops, and the troops became, hey, okay, we can.
Is this the one that says, like, these are the times that try men's souls and the no time for the suns? What is it, Sunshine Patriots or something like that?
Yes, that is. If ever people, that's probably one of the most famous lines in all of American early American history, and that, according to a lot of historians, is what got the troops say, okay, we have something to fight for. We can, you know, the things aren't quite lost yet. You know, we have to go do this. And they did, you know, Trenton was Washington's first victory. It was Paine's unique style, I think, that convinced them. In fact, the fact that Paine was there in camp, he wasn't just some guy, you know, in Congress saying, hey, don't give up the ship. You know, we can win this thing. He was there suffering with them. So, that, I think, helped as well.
Yeah, before we get too deep into, you know, like, the reason he's famous, the reason we know him today, what fascinated about me about your essay, George, was you pointed out Okay, so number one, I had known this, but it was good just to see it refreshed that this isn't like some boy that was born in Virginia or something, or even somebody who would come over, whatever, in 1740 or something, and been, right. You know, maybe his boy, but he really came relatively, you know, recently, before right before the hostilities broke out. But also the thing that I didn't know is one might have thought, wow, a guy like that with a golden pen, I mean, he must just have had a blessed life and just gone through and had nothing but victory, because what an account. And actually, no, that wasn't the case.
Not the case at all. He was, if you wanted to find a complete failure, it would be Thomas Paine. He went to school until the age of 13, I believe. He was born in a little town called Thetford, England. His father was a staymaker and a Quaker. His mother was an Anglican. But he seemed to side with his father religiously. Mm-hmm. After he dropped out of school at the age of 13, he became an apprentice in his father's staymaker business. He would, as I understand it, he took whale bones and converted them to stays for ladies' dresses. Of course, that would be the ladies that accompanied the gentlemen of the age, and not the run-of-the-mill women that they knew. So he stayed with his father's business for several years, then went out on his own and came back and went out on his own again. He was married twice. His first wife died in childbirth, and as well as the child. The child died, so Paine had no progeny. And his second wife, he wasn't actually divorced. They separated following Paine's visit to London to try to convince the Parliament to give raises to tax collectors. He was a tax collector at the time, an excise tax collector. And that didn't happen. He settled his debts and went on to London, where he met Benjamin Franklin. And Franklin was extremely impressed with Paine's debating and reasoning ability. He also met some scientists there too. So Paine always had a strong interest in science, and he could defend almost anything. So that's one of his strengths, and it's also something to be careful of. You know, you can read an essay by Thomas Paine and say, wow, that's a problem. That's a good point. He makes it very strongly. How can you possibly disagree with it? And in most cases, yeah, that's, you know, the facts are there. But he could also take a position, and I don't think he's, some people charge him with this, but he take a position that's not defensible. And make it sound like this is the way it should be. Anyway,
stop you, Jordan, it's just ironic that you're saying that. The reason I'm smiling is because, in like I said, in undergrad is when I really got fascinated with him. I knew of Common Sense or whatever, but right. I got into the Age of Reason, and I was like, wow, this guy, he wrote on The Rights of Man and all that stuff that right. Maybe we'll get into in a moment here. But my roommate also, like, for something he was doing for his political science class, picked something from Paine, and my roommate was more conservative, so he was more on the Edmund Burke side of the French Revolution question. And he showed me some argument that Paine made that, you know, it was very stridently argued, but it was nonsense. You know what I mean? But it was very eloquent. And so I realized, like, oh yeah, if Paine wanted to, like, he wasn't afraid to throw a BS argument at you, but he did it with such, you know, pizzazz that it was like, wow, that was impressive. Well, when you think about it, no, that's a terrible argument.
Yeah, that seemed to come, the ability to argue effectively seemed to come naturally to him. He had some experience before coming over to the colonies in, I think it was Lewes, L-A-W-E-S, if that's how you pronounce it, England, where he was a member of a local debate club, so to speak. It was very informal. And he was there, often won the crown for the best debater. And I think there is also a beer drinking thing too. So he knew, he learned how to debate, or maybe just brought on his natural tendency to debate. And he's never shy at all about voicing his opinion on anything, really, whether it be slavery, women's rights, marriage. His commentary covered a wide range of subjects.
So one thing you mentioned too, I just want to highlight, make sure people, is that one might have thought, or I guess one might have underestimated the impact of pamphleteers in, you know, colonial America right before the revolution, and thinking like, oh yeah, I mean, probably a lot of people couldn't even read. It was just a bunch of ignorant hicks tilling the soil, right? And maybe just some people in Philadelphia could read or something. And no, like you say, like I don't know if you have the figures hand, but I mean, common sense had a lot of copies that were printed up and distributed. It wasn't like 500 people read it.
Oh yeah, it was a bestseller. I don't know if they had that term in those days, but it sold a lot of copies. And Paine himself, the first edition of that, he just said, you know, common sense and blah blah by an Englishman, and that's, you know, that was it. He didn't put his name on it at all. And pamphlets, there are a lot of people who could read pamphlets directly. There are a lot who couldn't. And those who couldn't were eager to hear what he had to say. So you had meetings wherever, and someone would read the pamphlet aloud. And so that communicated to a lot of people just what was going on with what had been the start of the American Revolution, particularly following the Pyrrhic victory at Bunker Hill, the British Pyrrhic victory. Mm-hmm. And they said, what are we fighting for? That's, you know, and this, his pamphlet initially just was very moving to a lot of people. And it was like, it was a good fight type thing. Mm-hmm. Well, here's why we're fighting. We don't want to be governed by these guys anymore. One of his lines, I think, was, does it make sense for an island to be in charge of a continent?
Right, no, right. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
So he had a lot of lines like that. I mean, you could offer rebuttal to it, but they were willing to accept his arguments for the most part. Now, people like John Adams was one of Paine's great detractors. Yet, on the other hand, he would say things like, well, I think he's famous for the line that said, without the pen of Thomas Paine, the sword of Washington would have been raised in vain. Little poem there. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's probably true. You look at all that, what he wrote and what he did and how he influenced. If they had lost, going back to what I mentioned about the Trenton invasion, if he hadn't written that, if he had been discouraged and said, I'm going back to Philadelphia, which was, you know, close at hand, who knows? I mean, the troops were freezing cold. Someone else might have tried to write something or speak to them. No one was as eloquent and as moving as Paine. He was like a good coach, in a sense. You know, it wasn't just his arguments. The arguments are strong, but he was able to motivate them to get them moving. And that's what they needed to do. I said, look, you guys are tired, hungry. You're not being paid well, if being paid at all. We've been chased out of New York. We've had casualties. You're hurting, blah, 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 blah. Still, let's get to it. You know, we can't quit now. We're too close. We can do this. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I don't know how much detail I want to get into. Washington had a spy, I think his name was John Honeyman, who helped him assess the condition of the Hessians they were the German mercenaries who occupied Trenton. And he knew that the Hessians liked to celebrate Christmas in a kind of a drunken manner. And that on the morning, December the 26th, the morning following Christmas, they would be hung over. They would be sleeping off a hangover. Mm-hmm. It'd be a perfect time to attack. So that you had that information. And I think that was passed on to the troops as well. So we're going to catch these guys sleeping, literally. Mm-hmm. And we can, if we leave now, it was the middle of the night, whatever it was, just before, actually they left before midnight, I think, across the Delaware, and the famous picture of Washington standing up on the boat. And they marched 9 miles, I think it was, to Trenton, and pulled off the surprise and the victory. So, and it was the first military victory of the war. So that was, you know, that was a point of celebration. And Payne had, the information Washington had, plus Payne's essay, I think, helped carry on the war. Right. And he continued to write. As you know, the American crisis essays went on. He wrote those until the very end of the war. So, and yet, today, if you name the founders of this country, many people would not mention Thomas Paine. A lot of people never heard of him.
Right. I do. If maybe we could postpone, because I have a theory as to partly why that might be, but we need to cover more ground. So maybe like let's remember at the tail end of this to try to come back to why that might be. So can we? Well, so you mentioned something too that I, when I was younger and started learning more of his biographical details, I realized because like Thomas Jefferson's an amazing writer and a student of history and whatever, but you know he's not shivering in the cold fighting the British. And, you know, same like James Madison. And Washington is a great military victory, but it's not like you remember all the great essays that George Washington cranked out. So that's what's interesting with Paine is that he was both like the theorist and the practitioner,
right.
notwithstanding, you know, the his soldierly capabilities. You know, I don't know that he was a sharpshooter or something, but is this a time maybe would it be appropriate like to jump ahead to he also played a, you know, had a lot to do with the French Revolution?
Almost. Let me mention one thing.
Here. Okay, sure thing.
Trying to tie all this together. I read this somewhere, one of his biographers, and I cannot find it again. But this phrase, when the British fired Thomas Paine, it cost them his marriage, but it cost the British their American colonies.
Huh.
That, you know, he left when he was fired from his job. He had no choice. Well, he had a choice, but he decided to go to London, met Franklin. Franklin sent him over here. He wrote Common Sense, you know, and then the crisis essays, and he was influential with the Continental Congress and so forth. That makes a lot of sense. That ties a lot of detail together. Mm-hmm. I found that a very profound observation.
And maybe, you know, instead of us being mad at his wife, she could say, no, the man I married, you're better than asking for a tax hike to pay tax collectors. Go cross the ocean and make something of yourself. I know you're better than this. And he did, by God.
Yeah. And I also have an article that says, what if Paine had not written Common Sense? Mm-hmm. And yet you have members of Congress who wanted independence. Mm-hmm. What would they have done? Would they have tried to hire an outside writer, some pamphleteer other than Paine to write it? And what would be the result of that? Mm-hmm. And I speculated a little bit on what might happen. So anyway, you want to talk about the Paine's influence in the French Revolution?
I think so. You know, and like him versus Edmund Burke, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So is it Rights of Man? Is that the book now we should be talking about?
Rights of Man was a response to Burke's speech in Parliament, as well as a book Burke wrote, attacking the principles and the what was going on in Paris and France regarding their revolution. Burke was a conservative, member of Parliament. He believed in the monarchy. He believed in the way things, the status quo. Everything was just wonderful. Of course, he was, you know, I don't know Burke's background. He said some good things earlier about the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. I had one point, a good quote from Burke about when the king was trying to punish the colonies for like dumping the tea in the Boston Harbor, he said, you're not going to tame the Patriots this way. The colonists this way. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten the quote. I'm sorry. I don't remember. But he was somewhat sympathetic to the cause, but he looked at France and said, this is just a chaos, a crowd. They don't know what they're talking about. They don't have any kind of they're a monarchy. It's not the same thing as the United States. So he, the American colonies, he was critical of that, and he was said that the laws that England had now to carry on those laws from generation to generation, the basic laws at least, shouldn't change. You know, the idea of a parliament and monarchy. And Paine just tore that to pieces, and he did it in kind of a jovial style, but he dedicated it. Rights of Man was in two parts. First part was dedicated to George Washington. He believed that Washington fought for the right principles. He believed that the French were fighting for those same principles, forgetting that the colonists, they had the one monarch they had was overseas in England, and they didn't like him. They were afraid to attack the king because a lot of them were English, and they were brought up to worship the guy, worship that position at least. The authority figure was not something that they liked. France had a king that, I don't know how Paine went on. When they decided, well, should we execute the king? You know, he was a terrible tyrant and so forth. Paine wrote a defense of what the king did as a king, but why he should not be executed. But he and his family should be exiled, probably to America. And one of his reasonings was that the king was a good friend of the United States, of the colonists, when they were fighting the British. And how would it look to the states now if the French executed the guy who was such a profound friend of the American people?
Right.
And that didn't go. But they attacked him for being, they said, well, you're going to take that view because you're a Quaker. And of course, Paine didn't speak French. And he wrote his defense in English, and then had a friend on the committee read it in French to the rest of them. And of course, they had many enemies. No. And the first thing they did was when they started reading this essay, they said, "You know, this isn't what Thomas Paine really believes. He's a Quaker. He's going to be for peace. He's not going to be for executing the king under any conditions." Mm-hmm. So this automatically, you know. Yeah, Paine was a Quaker, but he also advocated, he was also, in common sense, he was saying, let's continue this war and win our independence. So war was justified in that case to him. Mm-hmm. And yet he is, if you read Rights of Man, you'll find that his view on war is very contemporary to us, to libertarians at least. It's the reason taxes, wars exist is so that you can raise taxes, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So can I just stop? This is a big picture kind of simplistic summary, but my takeaway from what was going on, that, you know, you had the American Revolution, obviously 1776, and then so on is when it, you know, Declaration and so forth. And then was French Revolution, 1789? And Burke was arguing that, say what you will about the colonists breaking away and, you know, this new country, the Americas, but they thought, rightly or wrongly, that, you know, their English prerogatives and the unwritten constitution and, you know, the rights that people have vis-a-vis their government and whatever, you know, no taxation without representation, that kind of stuff. They were asserting their rights as Englishmen. They felt they weren't getting satisfaction, so that's why they broke away. So that was like a conservative break, a secession. It wasn't like a revolution in social order, whereas the French, Burke is arguing, they're overturning the monarchy, they're overturning the clergy, they're just, you know, look at all the rivers of blood. This is just crazy stuff. This is an angry mob. This isn't, you know, people concerned about the protection of individual liberty. This is just an angry mob running around killing people and, you know, breaking stuff. And then Paine was saying, no, the French Revolution really is the same spirit as the American Revolution.
Yeah. I don't That was a major blunder on Payne's part.
Right. But do you agree that, I mean, again, that's the big picture. That's kind of what the central theme was. Okay.
Yeah. And when the Jacobins took over, there was some, you know, what there was a, how do you pronounce it? Girondists and the Jacobins.
Mm-hmm.
The more conservative Girondists were just pushed aside by Robespierre and his boys.
Mm-hmm.
And they decided that they didn't want any foreigners in their assemblies. So they picked Payne and said, get him out of here. And then he was finally put into the Luxembourg prison in Paris. And Payne thought, well, I've got contacts outside of this. I'll get, well, he didn't have the, he was not popular with the people who could remove him, you know, mm-hmm. save him. He was only popular really with the working class, you might say. Mm.
So can I just start again, just to underscore for people to get, so that again, going back to when the more I learned about him, I thought, wow, this guy, not that I agreed with everything he wrote, but like what a heroic, bold, brave figure.
Right.
So he goes over to France to, you know, try to give the intellectual justification for what they're doing. So he's their buddies, you know, in terms of the revolutionaries. And then, but he says, hey, I don't think you should execute the king. Like just, right. you deposed him. He's not a threat to you anymore. You know, he wrote a whole treatise mocking the notion of a monarchy, you know, like it was really good stuff, folks. If you haven't read it, like just going through like the very like hereditary monarchy, he just mocks that concept. Like, this is so stupid.
Yes.
And yet because he said, but I don't think you should kill him. They imprisoned him and they're going to kill him. Like kind of showing, you know, that, yeah, these are your buddies and they turned on you in a heartbeat.
Yeah. Well, keep in mind, he went over to England initially to find someone to build a bridge he had designed, an iron bridge. And he finally succeeded. And the reason he left the colony, he couldn't get anyone in Philadelphia to build it. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've read, at least, whether he also had some notion of just spreading his ideas around the world. I don't know. And he became mm-hmm. friends with Burke. They were buddies.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was only Jefferson was in Paris at the time that Payne was in England with Burke, and Payne and Jefferson were exchanging letters, and Payne would share some of those thoughts, at least, or the letters with Burke. And Jefferson was looking at the formation of this French Revolution. And Burke was horrified at what was going on. He said, I'm going to write about it. You know, I'm going to put this, let it be known. And he stood up in Parliament and critiqued the revolution. He also wrote the very well-known, to conservatives at least, treatise, if you want to call it that, criticizing the French Revolution. So, and that became a break. And then Payne, of course, and Rights of Man attacked the Burke position.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was the first installment of that. And then the second Rights of Man part two, he went on to develop it even further.
Mm-hmm. And that I would say, like, so I don't know what your position, George. I'm an anarcho-capitalist in the Rothbardian traditions. So, but in terms of like old school minarchism, like a night watchman state, like you've got Ayn Rand, Frederick Bastiat's The Law is pretty good on that. But also the rights, Thomas Paine's The Rights of Man, I thought was a pretty good exposition of that, you know, that people have natural rights and they can delegate it for practical reasons to some third party. But like that's where legitimate government comes from in that, you know, treatise that he's writing there, that people have these original rights that they delegate just because you can't defend yourself from a foreign army, that kind of stuff.
Right. If you read Rights of Man and other Payne writings, you can very easily find source material for anarchism.
Mm-hmm.
And I have read your book, Chaos Theory, several times, and other things as well. But he says, essentially, whatever government claims to do, society does on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And government amounts to nothing more than an imposition on society, which, you know, is the world without government, conceptually. And what do we need it for? But he never goes further. I mean, he's really attacking his other positions where he said, we need a government to do those things which we can't do on our own, or which it is inconvenient to do on our own, or whatever. I said, but even as it's in its best state, this is one of the quotes in Common Sense, government is a necessary evil.
Yeah, I just looked it up, George. So society in every state is a blessing, but government, even in its best state, is but a necessary evil, in its worst state, an intolerable one.
Right, yeah. Of course, I would say it's an unnecessary evil.
Right.
But I think you would too. At least government as it exists.
And he's right, like what we mean by that term. Yeah.
He qualified it. So I think that's one of his stronger legitimate arguments. Mm-hmm. In his critique of government. And another, if you look, one of the footnotes in Rights of Man, I think it was in part one, but it might be part two, I'm not sure. He says something to the effect of, you can scarcely touch on any subject without alluding to some corruption in government. Mm-hmm. And as a footnote, he was talking about something else entirely in the text, but he comes back and says, you know, keep in mind that government is corrupt, and that's, of course, it's corrupt. To look at the very nature of government, it's, well, you know all that. So what he did, and this is a couple of things about Paine. He remembered what he wrote. He could quote things verbatim. Mm-hmm. I don't know how, really, if he could do everything he wrote that way, but he was known for remembering very closely, at least, the things he put down in writing. Mm-hmm. And he wrote quite a bit, as you know. And just one indication of the power of his intellect, when he was imprisoned in the Luxembourg, and, you know, after the Robespierre took over and started executing people, he wrote the first installment of Age of Reason.
Mm-hmm.
He did not have access to a Bible. And if you've read that essay, book, whatever you want to call it, it's incredible. People who are consider themselves very religious and Christians, they read it. They have not said, oh, he's got that all entirely wrong or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't read a rebuttal of it. Maybe you have. If you're a Christian, you can say, well, we take these things on faith, but you know, he's just wrong, period. But I think he has his own. Teddy Roosevelt, one of his famous remarks on Paine was, he's a filthy little atheist. He was not, he made that clear. Paine made that clear in the opening of the first installment of Age of Reason, that he was not. That he believed in I believe in a creation, by which he meant all of reality. You can see it yourself. It doesn't depend upon this, that. It doesn't depend upon the will of man to have it published or anything like that. This is it. You can see it with your eyes. And that's what he believed. And he did not believe in the organized, what we call organized religion,
mm-hmm.
of any faith whatsoever. And he said your part in defending your religion. I'm going to say my part. But yet, and those views, his views were not by all, it was strange or unique at that period of time. Jefferson had his own version of the Bible. Other philosophers had things that were critical of the concept of God and so forth. And Paine just went on. Paine accepted he didn't go any more. His view has been classified as deism.
You know? Right. That's what I was going to say, that if we had to pick a term, that would be.
Yeah.
So he believed in a God, so showing Teddy Roosevelt's statement doesn't really work.
It doesn't work at all.
Would you agree? I think he went so far as to say, like, it offended him. Like the notion of revealed religion, like you're telling me this being creates the whole universe and we can see the majesty and the intricate inner workings. And then we're going to rely on some stories written by shepherds 2000 years ago with all kinds of crazy stuff happening. That doesn't come on. That's ridiculous. I think that was, yeah.
Yeah. He said, why should we believe this? This guy said he saw this, that, or the other, and it makes no sense. why should we believe it? You know, believe what you can see with your eyes, touch with your hands, and so forth, and go from there. And I don't know. I'm not familiar with Quakerism. I know they're very peaceful and so forth. Mm-hmm. But they do believe in the. I think they believe in the Christian God. Maybe I'm totally wrong, but they're certainly not atheists. And so he was going beyond his upbringing there.
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean, yeah, I'm by no means an expert on, but I don't think Quakers are deists for sure.
Yeah.
So I think that he was a very broadly construed Quaker, if he still used that term. But yeah, just to underscore, you said that. So he's in prison, and I think there was a period like it was an open question whether they were going to kill him, like right. the French revolutionaries, again, because for the audacity of him saying, "Don't kill the king, he's not a threat to you anymore, you deposed him."
Yeah.
So, and then he's sitting in there, and you're right. Well, what does he do? Does he like just do push-ups? Does he just wallow in his mitt? No, he decides, you know what? I'm going to write a critique of the Christian Bible.
Yeah.
And he does it from memory. And then what's funny too is, I know you know this, but just I thought it was that after he gets out, he then writes part two of The Age of Reason, and he starts out saying something like, wow, I knew the Bible was bad from my recollection, but now that I've been furnished with a copy of it, now that I'm out of prison, like, you priests are really in for it.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was just kind of fun. And again, so what I'm going to do, you made me realize the story. I found his arguments compelling back when I first read that because I was an atheist at the time. Now I've since rediscovered my faith, so I should go back like on my own podcast. I'll probably go through and see, like, evaluate his arguments to see, because you're right. It was a pretty strong critique of the Christian theology and, you know, the biblical accounts and whatnot. So he said stuff like, because some of the gospel, I just remember one of them. One of the gospel accounts says that after Jesus' resurrection, thousands of people rose up from the graves and were walking around. And so Payne says, are you telling me that that happened, but three of the other writers didn't bother to write that down? They didn't think that was worth mentioning? Are you kidding me? You know, that kind of stuff. So
it'd be very difficult to argue with. So, I mean, if you go back now and read Age of Reason, I don't think you're going to say, he's totally wrong there or something like that. I mean, it's hard to argue with the guy.
Yeah.
Hard to come up with counter arguments, rebuttals, whatever you want to call them. But anyhow.
I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but it's just funny you're saying it because how that I was tipped off to that is I was at Hillsdale College, which I'm sure you know is very conservative.
Yes.
It's not officially Christian, but. You know, probably 95% of the people there were Christian. And it was in the English class. At the time, I'm undergrad. I'm actually an atheist at this point. And my English professor, who was very Christian, we said something and he goes, oh, yeah, that reminds me of Thomas Paine, who said, like, my church is my mind or something like that. Or right. I forget the quote, but he was saying, like, I don't need organized religion because the nature and everything provides in my reason, whatever. Yeah. And then so that was. I said, oh, really? The same Thomas Paine that wrote Common Sense was into religious stuff? And that's what made me go read it. It was funny. It was because of a complimentary thing that a Christian professor at Hillsdale told me. So anyway.
Yeah. That opening, that's the opening of Age of Reason, where he talks about, you know, you've got your point of view, and then I'm going to state mine. And he puts it, I don't believe in the, the Catholic Church, the Greek Church, or this, that, or the other. I'm in favor of no church, whatever. Mm-hmm. My own, like you said, my church is my mind. And I said, well, this is the Age of Reason. He's using his brains. Mm-hmm. And that was consistent with the Enlightenment mood of the time, too. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of thinkers who were questioning just, you know, Spinoza and so forth, who were questioning everything, including the existence of God. And certainly the church had been, guilty of tremendous travesties against people. Mm-hmm. And he likened, one of the things, he likened the church to religion as he likened government to, you know, to liberty. I mean, you know, the government crushed liberty and the church crushed a true religion, which he believed was, which he called the creation with a capital C. And he had some brilliant ways of expressing that. And I would invite people who have a low opinion or have no opinion or a low opinion of pain to read Age of Reason and just see what he means. Mm-hmm.
Well, in the time we have left here, George, maybe can we revisit that question we raised that, yeah, if you ask people, list the American founding fathers and they started rattling it off, I doubt many people would mention Paine, even though, like you say, there's many respected people from the time that, you know, his contemporaries who would have said that, yeah, that the existence of the United States, it's not obvious that they would have won the revolution had it not been for Paine.
Yes.
And the fact that he fought and so forth, it wasn't just that, you know, he was some guy writing essays. So what's your, I have some theories myself, but I'm curious, what do you think? Why is that?
Two things. Mm-hmm. At the end of the war, a friend of John Adams, and who were, herself was well known as a playwright and a poet, Mercy Otis Warren, she wrote a comprehensive 3-volume history of the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. And that was the first, as far as I know, the first such thing written about the American, you know, after the war and the Americans were victorious. She wrote that they had asked, someone in Congress had asked Paine if he would do it, and he turned it down for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Maybe he would post. He said, "Well, I'll get around to it someday." But she jumped right in. She wrote that, and Thomas Paine was literally a footnote, only a footnote in that 3-volume thing. Hmm. He played almost no role, and then of course, so that tended to minimize his view public publicity. And then, of course, Age of Reason. Mm-hmm. There is a strong movement, I think, about the time that reached the American states, a revival, so to speak, of religion. And here comes this Age of Reason from Thomas Paine to, that didn't go over well. When Thomas Paine died in 1809 in the States, in New Rochelle, New York, I believe, his funeral was attended by six people, none of them VIPs, not even Jefferson came to his funeral. And they were buddies when he came back to the States after exiting France. They were close friends. He would enjoy supper with Jefferson and his daughters in the White House, and sometimes one of the Federalists would be there, a congressman or something, and they were just shocked that Paine would be so familiar with the President of the United States. You know, Jefferson was just a good friend. Anyway, Paine had six people at his funeral, none of them VIPs. When Franklin died, he had 20,000. I mean, that's just, Franklin, is he a founder? I guess, certainly.
That's what I was going to say. Like, one possible angle would be to say, well, it's because he wasn't, like, in the early American government, but, you know, Franklin had posts, and I guess, what do you go to the Continental Congress or something, but Franklin was not, Secretary of State or something, but yet he's clearly, with people, what is he, on a $100 bill or something, right? So,
yeah. He's very influential.
It that it was just by the time Paine died, he was nothing and nobody cared? Or was it like it would have been a signal if you went to his funeral and so certain people didn't go because they didn't want to be seen going to his funeral?
Both. Okay. Really. The people were afraid to associate with the author of Age of Reason.
Okay.
Why bother? Because here's this scholar, Mercy Otis Warren. She wrote this wonderful history of the American Revolution, and Paine was nothing,
Yeah. So, yeah.
Well,
I was going to say that was my theory too. The religious ones, because for folks, if you don't, It's not enough to say, well, but I mean, Thomas Jefferson also, he's got some stuff he wrote in his diary that was kind of quite, but Paine's, when Paine took a hammer to something or, an axe, he didn't screw around. So the Age of Reason, just like in the Rights of Man, he mocked monarchy. in the Age of Reason, he mocks like the New Testament accounts and stuff. So you can see how back then, how scandalous that would have been. And yeah, people who liked him personally might have just said, yeah, I can't officially be associated with you at this point.
Yeah, that's too bad, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the thing about the funeral, that's anyway.
Yeah. He's still one of my heroes.
Okay. Yeah, no, I like the guy. Again, I can even not like now he's more human to me that, you know, like with all of his shortcomings or whatever, he's not this mythical thing. Whereas when I was younger, I think I really picked, like, if I had to pick one human being that I wanted to be, like, it would have been, you know, I want to be Thomas Paine when I grew up kind of thing. And now, obviously, my views have evolved and whatever, and he's a man, but he made mistakes. Yeah. But anyway, I can respect what he was doing. Okay, well, do you have any final thoughts on Thomas Paine or, you know, lessons for today, anything like that?
Well, I just encourage people to, if they wonder about Paine's effect on the revolution, to remember that little phrase that, for one thing, he was not born in the colonies. Mm-hmm. He was an Englishman. And the phrase was, when the English fired Thomas Paine, cost him his marriage. They broke up. But then it cost the British their American colonies. I thought that was a very profound, very concise summary of his effect. Mm-hmm. What happened? Just, if you want to put it in just a nutshell phrase, that does it. But you have to know the background. You have to know what's going on. And I think there's a lot of truth to that.
And maybe just to elaborate on that, again, it's not that, oh yeah, this was just a whiz kid. And from the time he was eight, everybody knew this guy's going to be important. That if you checked in with him in 1773, you would have thought he was a loser.
Oh yeah.
And look what he went on to do. So don't give up, kids.
Yeah. And he, and one other little thing, when he said, okay, I'm going to get on a boat and sail to the colonies and have this letter from Franklin in my hand, and I'm going to become a school teacher, do some good things. He almost died. I mean, it took him 6 weeks after he arrived in Philadelphia before he could get out of bed and move around.
Oh yeah, I forgot that was in your essay. I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so he had to be carried off the ship. I mean, that's how weak he was.
Yeah.
So things weren't, and he finally got a job. Well, we can go into that. He got a job writing essays for a local magazine, and that he influenced a lot of people there. He increased the circulation of the magazine. So that showed that, okay, he's got this power of the pen. Mm-hmm. And then I think it was Benjamin Rush, who was a famous physician at the time, said, hey, why don't you write something about the what's going on here? This was after Bunker Hill. And just I don't know if they gave him any guidelines, but I think it was just a historical thing. And Paine had been told by his editor, as the owner of the magazine, said, we're just writing essays without, we don't want opinion, you know, we just want straight factual reporting. Paine, of course, you couldn't, Paine didn't follow that advice at all. And following the advice, or whatever, if he was given any advice for writing common sense, he, of course, turned that upside down and made it a very strong argument for independence. So, he was quite a character.
Well, we got to stop there, folks. My guest has been George Smith. George, we'll link to your essay. I know you've written another one, too, so we'll link to all your stuff at the show notes page, folks, who want to read George's writings on Paine. Thanks so much for your time, George.
Thank you for having me, Bob. I enjoyed it immensely.
Yeah, me too. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Check back next week for a new episode of the Human Action Podcast. In the meantime, you can find more content like this on Mises.org.